You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Support for this program comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a talk by Vijay Prashad in conversation with Melanie K. Yazzie on Wednesday, September 25th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic in Santa Fe. Vijay Prashad is a Marxist historian and journalist and the author of 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. He also is the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, a global movement-driven research institution. Tickets available at the Lensic or lensic.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Lauren Ansel Myers. She's a professor of integrative biology and statistics and data science at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. In Santa Fe, on September 23rd and 24th, she will be giving the Santa Fe Institute's 2019 ULAM Lecture Series. It's two nights at the Lensic Performing Arts Center, titled Preventing the Next Global Pandemic. Welcome, Lauren.
I'm so excited to come to Santa Fe and very happy to be talking to you today.
Excellent. Thank you. So you use the tools of complex system science to predict and respond to epidemics. And in the past, we've been able to defeat some past plagues like smallpox and bubonic plague and cholera. Those aren't, in general, big problems these days. What are the infectious diseases today that pose a danger and that could turn into epidemics and global pandemics?
So the one that keeps me up at night and gets me to work in the morning is influenza. As you may know, every year we have a seasonal epidemic of influenza where in the northern hemisphere it starts to spread after kids go back to school in the fall. It typically peaks sometime between December and March, and then it subsides by late spring, early summer. It's not pleasant to get flu. You know, typically people feel very ill, they do recover, but every year, tens of thousands of people just in the U.S. alone actually die from seasonal flu. That is a huge public health burden in terms of life lost and hospitalizations and medical costs. But in addition to the viruses that circulate the globe every year, there is the persistent threat of a new influenza virus that is particularly virulent, emerging from animal populations into humans and causing death and devastation on a much larger scale. In recent history, in 1918, we had exactly one of those types of pandemics. It was the Spanish influenza pandemic of 1918, and it's estimated that somewhere between 20 and 100 million people died in a matter of months from that particularly virulent influenza virus.
Which is almost inconceivable today, but, you know, it happened, and we still have deaths from the flu. There are names for flu like bird flu and swine flu, and you mentioned animals, viruses moving from animal populations to humans. Is that the normal trajectory of the flu?
Seasonal flu, the flu that infects us year on year, typically is spreading just within human populations, and it sort of percolates around the globe. But these new potentially devastating viruses, these potentially pandemic viruses, usually they enter the human population from domesticated animal populations. So for example, the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic is thought to have emerged from swine farms into human populations in Mexico. There are strains of avian flu, such as H5N1, H7N9, which fortunately don't have the ability to spread from person to person, yet people are occasionally infected through exposure to infected birds. And those particular viruses are incredibly deadly. People have very high case fatality rates when they're exposed to them. But like I said, we are fortunate that those particular viruses don't have the ability to spread from person to person.
So you are both a biologist and a statistics and data science person. You combine those things into basically kind of new tools for predicting and modeling the spread of diseases like the flu. What are some of these new tools and how do they work?
So most of the research that I have done over the last almost two decades has been using mathematical modeling, quantitative tools from engineering, statistics and data science to ask three basic questions about viruses. Where are they spreading today? Where might they be spreading tomorrow? And how can we use our limited global health resources to minimize the damage, to reduce illness, and to prevent deaths from these diseases? And we use a large number of techniques. One of the things I will be talking about in Monday's lecture is how we use network models to understand what is fueling the transmission of viruses around the globe and where are key pressure points for stopping their spread. So network modeling is a very active area of research. A lot of the early development of the tools actually came out of the Santa Fe Institute and work that was being done in the early 2000s. And one of the approaches we take is first we go out in the real world and we say, what are the patterns of interactions that people have with each other on a local scale from within households and hospitals all the way to a global scale? How are people being moved around the planet via international air travel? We try to understand, find data that tell us what those patterns of interactions, what those patterns of contacts are. And then once we have a handle on the structure of those human networks, we apply methods from an area of statistical physics called percolation theory to understand how those structures fuel the spread of outbreaks. What parts of the globes are going to be most vulnerable to emergence? Where is disease going to spread most quickly? And the area of physics that I mentioned, percolation theory, it has been around for over 50 years, and it was developed originally to model the flow of a liquid through some sort of substrate where you have a bunch of channels that are either opened or closed. And based on the configuration of those channels, you could calculate, and based also on the viscosity of the liquid, you could calculate where exactly and how exactly the liquid would permeate through the material. And it's sort of an analogous process with humans, based on the patterns of interactions between people around the globe, how can the disease or the liquid move and where is it likely to move?
When you do this kind of application of the models you're talking about, do you end up coming up with basically patterns that are commonsensical, or do you sometimes find stuff that's like super counterintuitive?
Sometimes we find things that are very intuitive, but then there is still value to it. Sometimes we find things that are very intuitive, and yet it's very useful to quantify things, right? So if we're trying to decide we have a limited number of vaccines, we may have an intuitive strategy for distributing them, but we may want to know exactly how many of the vaccines should we give to one population versus another. So sometimes it's intuitive, but there's something to gain from quantifying and estimating the potential burden of disease. And sometimes we find things that are very counterintuitive. For example, or maybe not even counterintuitive, but just surprising or unexpected. One of the very first epidemiological studies that I was involved in which we applied network-based models to trying to understand outbreak dynamics, was a study that I conducted with the CDC in the early 2000s to address the challenge of controlling the spread of walking pneumonia in closed facilities like healthcare centers or college campuses. And we had some data from an outbreak in a psychiatric institution in Evansville, Indiana. And when you looked at the data from this outbreak, you saw that many of the patients in this facility had gotten infected, and there were really only a couple of caregivers of healthcare workers who were on the list of those infected. And once we built a model of the network of interactions in this facility, we realized that it was very likely that those few caregivers that got infected were probably the primary vectors moving it from one group of patients to another group of patients. So it's intuitive in retrospect, but it really took thinking about the pattern of interactions, the network of interactions, to recognize where hot spots for transmission were.
One of the things you just mentioned is that there are limits of resources. And, you know, infectious diseases are the kind of things where you have to prepare for relatively infrequent scenarios where a large number of people have an illness all at once. Then the rest of the year, it's relatively quiet, or the rest of the season. And how do you see to it that there are enough resources when they're needed? And how does your work help with that?
That's a really important question. And the recent 2009 H1N1 pandemic was fortunately not as severe as we are concerned a pandemic could be. And there were a lot of sort of lessons learned in the aftermath about, you know, would we have had enough antiviral medications on hand if it had been worse? Would we have had enough ventilators available in hospitals to keep people breathing if the burden of hospitalizations had been higher? And so in the aftermath of 2009, a lot of public health agencies really began to see the value of modeling in decision support and helping to ensure that we have the right kinds of stockpiles, the right number of medical countermeasures in the right places should the big one arise. And so we have had the opportunity to work with public health decision makers to build models that learn from past data and help them navigate these kinds of questions. So, for example, one question that did come up and may come up again if we were faced with another pandemic is how do we prioritize a limited supply of vaccines against a new virus? As of now, if a new influenza virus starts spreading, it will take a good 4, 5, 6 months between identifying that virus and actually being able to deploy the first vaccines to people around the world or around the U.S. By that time, a lot of people may have already become infected. And so if we just have a few vaccines available, who do we prioritize? Do we prioritize the people that are most at risk for severe outcomes? And depending on the virus, that might be young people or older people or immunocompromised people. If we are thinking geographically, do we prioritize the big cities where there are lots of people or the smaller cities? And, you know, one might immediately think, well, it's the big cities that stop transmission. But if the vaccines don't become available until 6 months into a pandemic, it may be that the epidemic has already run its course in those big cities. And it would be almost a waste of vaccines, and we should deploy them in places that haven't seen the worst of the epidemic yet. And so we build models that simulate different pandemic scenarios, and we make these models and the results of these models accessible to public health decision makers to help them decide when, where, and how they should deploy these kinds of countermeasures.
It's so interesting to me that the outbreak of the flu 100 years ago was so very severe, and today, at least so far, we don't have those kinds of numbers of deaths and very severe illnesses. Today, there are so many more people moving around because of global travel and air travel and all kinds of things. How do we understand that?
Well, that happened to be a particularly virulent virus, and it is not fully clear why that particular virus was so much more deadly than the other pandemic viruses that have arisen over the last century. That said, if you look at some of these new threats, like the avian viruses we talked about earlier, they actually have higher case fatality rates than that deadly 1918 flu. So if one of those viruses actually evolved the ability to spread from person to person, that compounded by what you just mentioned, global air travel and the rapidity with which diseases can move around the globe, we could be facing a catastrophe much, much worse than even that 1918 pandemic. So I think the threat is still there and the threat is real. But it would sort of take the perfect storm of having a particularly virulent virus that also is quite infectious.
And that's what you call the big one.
That could give rise to a big one, meaning a really devastating global pandemic.
Are medications like significantly better than they were 100 years ago? In other words, every time you know, I or anybody I know gets a virus, I mean, we're not talking about HIV, but whether it be the common cold or the flu, you go to bed, take chicken soup, and let it run its course.
Yeah, so certainly medications have changed. So, well, antibiotics, you know, those are medications against bacteria, not viruses. However, sometimes when people get a viral infection like influenza, they become more susceptible to bacterial infections like pneumonias. And so antibiotics, although they are not meant and they do not cure viruses, they can actually be helpful at reducing the kind of indirect health risks associated with viruses. And so antibiotics are useful in our arsenal. But then antiviral medications that have been developed over the last few decades, you may have heard of oseltamivir. It goes by the name of Tamiflu as well. Those drugs are useful, but they're not a silver bullet against influenza. So Tamiflu has been shown to reduce the severity of illness and potentially reduce how long somebody is infectious, but only if they are treated within the first 24 to 48 hours of symptoms, and it doesn't make you instantaneously better. Those drugs can also be used prophylactically. So if you have a first responder that you want to protect against infection, or you have a member of a household that's in a high risk group and you know someone else in the household has become infected, you can treat somebody with oseltamivir to prevent them or reduce the severity of illness should they become exposed. But they're only protected as long as they're actually actively taking the drug. So those are Tamiflu, and there's a new antiviral that was just approved for human use called baloxavir that is thought to be able to, or has been shown to be able to reduce your viral load even more quickly than oseltamivir. And there's a lot of activity in trying to develop even more effective antivirals. They can be very useful, but they really, at this point in the way they're used, are not able to really stop transmission, you know, stop an epidemic in its tracks. And in order for them to really significantly reduce the burden of illness, people have to have access to them very quickly, you know, immediately after having symptoms. Mm-hmm. So vaccines really do remain our most effective tool in the fight against influenza. However, because the virus is continually evolving and because a new pandemic won't look anything like the influenza viruses that are currently circulating, the lead-up time actually is the big challenge in terms of being able to use vaccines effectively to stop an epidemic.
And even when it's not an epidemic, I mean, every fall they say, well, the new flu vaccine is here, but it may not be that effective. And then another one comes out sometime during the flu season that is more up to date. And it's pretty complicated and pretty hard to really get it right.
So the annual flu vaccine, so every year, almost every year, with few exceptions, we really do have a full-blown epidemic of flu in this country, in the Northern Hemisphere. And the virus that causes our annual epidemics of flu is constantly evolving. And so the vaccines that we produce in one year against the viruses that are currently circulating may not be effective in the next year or 2 years later if the virus has evolved to be different from what was circulating when the vaccine was first developed. So we have this constant race, and this is one of the main challenges with seasonal flu, is to try to identify which viruses are most likely to be circulating next year and put them in the vaccine. We have a big challenge in terms of the time lag here too. So the way it works is we have a flu season that's, you know, about to probably get up and running now, and public health agencies are going to be monitoring exactly which viruses are spreading in the coming months. In February of 2020, you know, coming up February, sometime in February, the pharmaceutical companies that make flu vaccines, the global health organizations, are all going to get together and say, what do we need to put in the vaccine for next year, for next October? So they have to decide in February, looking at what's circulating now, what is likely to be circulating 6 months from now. And they have to make the decision then, because of the vaccine production process, what we'll be vaccinating for 6 months out. And a lot can change. We can't see the future. We don't have that crystal ball for what's going to happen with influenza 6 months out, let alone 2 months out.
Right.
And it's locked in then. And so then when next October comes around, what people can get vaccinated for was decided on, you know, 6 months before.
Right, exactly. And I think that's one of the things about complex systems science that's so interesting, is that it really shows us the limits of prediction. Like, it's hard to predict the weather, no matter how much information you have. And so there are real limits of prediction in influenza and really in all kinds of infectious diseases. Is that right?
Absolutely. And the idea that we can forecast an outbreak is, although it maybe have been in people's minds for a long time, it is something that has really just in the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years become an explicit goal of research and public health agencies. In fact, several years ago, the CDC launched its first flu forecasting contest. It was called, I think, something like Predict the Seasonal Flu Epidemic. And researchers from all over the world tried to put their best complex systems models and statistical models to work at taking real-time data and trying to forecast when was the epidemic going to start in the U.S., when was it going to peak, how many people would be infected at the peak, and when would it eventually subside. And there were lots of interesting modeling approaches and lots of creative use of data. One of the, you know, big differences between trying to forecast disease outbreaks and trying to forecast the weather is just the amount of data. You know, for weather, there are climate stations all over the globe collecting enormous volumes of data every second of the day. Whereas for influenza, you know, if we want to forecast the next pandemic, we really only have 5 or 6 pandemics on record for which we have very limited data. If you want to forecast seasonal flu, maybe we have decades or maybe a century, you know, maybe 100 examples of flu pandemics, but that is little data. That is very far from big data. And so, you know, what can, if we want to be able to forecast, we have to learn from data, what are the typical cycles, the annual patterns of flu? And so one of the big challenges and the things that have really kind of fueled some of the interesting modeling work is how can we use all different kinds of data to advance that program? So for example, maybe almost 10 years ago, Google had the idea of what became Google Flu Trends, that if you monitor how many people are Googling for words related to flu, like influenza, flu, fever, sore throat, Tamiflu, you might actually be able to estimate how many people are sick with flu. Because what do people do when they get sick or when somebody in their family gets sick? They go to the computer and they Google for information. And Google launched this program, Google Flu Trends, and they use CDC data. They use machine learning algorithms to fit their data to the CDC data. And they were able to successfully show that Google time series actually did reflect to some extent the actual patterns of disease activity around the country. And so that was the first example of this. And now researchers in the field are using complex systems models that capture all the different complex inputs, including weather and human behavior into the and even viral evolution that affect the circulation of flu. And then they also try to creatively mine different sources of data that might indirectly reflect who is sick with flu, who might be spreading flu, where will flu go next.
What are some of the examples of human behavior that you're looking at that help spread the flu or not spread it?
Well, most fundamentally, it is just what are those daily contact patterns. The thing about flu is that as soon as you are infected, if you're infected one day, you may not develop symptoms for a good 2-3 days, but you become infectious before you even develop symptoms. So while you'd like to think that, you know, if people just behaved right, you know, when they got sick, they stayed at home, they didn't send their kids to daycare, they didn't go to work themselves, even if people behaved perfectly like that, flu would still spread because people are infectious before they realize they're sick, before they start feeling bad. And so a really huge part of understanding how human behavior contributes to the spread of flu is just understanding what do people's daily interactions look like. And so, you know, it's behavior from how are people traveling via air around, you know, between major cities around the world, What do people's kind of work, what does workflow data look like? How many people are driving to the next zip code or the next county? It's also understanding, you know, for more severe illnesses where a lot of the transmission might take place in healthcare settings for a disease like Ebola or SARS, where it's caregivers, healthcare workers being exposed. It's what is actual the caregiving behavior, what kinds of hygienic precautions are being adhered to in healthcare settings. In our own work, we have looked at everything from, you know, what kind of hygienic precautions are being taken in hospitals to which Wi-Fi hotspots are people using at cafes in a major urban setting. So really, it's the full gamut from recreational activities to healthcare settings to global travel, because all of that can contribute to the local and long-range transmission of diseases.
Is there anything that that public health people can do to change people's behavior if they're already spreading the disease without even knowing they're doing so?
Well, it is very disease specific. What constitutes a good intervention or what constitutes what we call like non-pharmaceutical interventions. What can people do beyond getting access to drugs or vaccines to prevent transmission? And, you know, with something like flu, I think, you know, public health agencies are already trying to get the word out that during flu season, people should wash their hands. They should, during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, they were recommending that people do, the elbow bump or something instead of hugging and kissing. And so just, you know, people using common sense about keeping their distance and washing their hands. But, you know, the recommendation is going to be different for a sexually transmitted disease or for a foodborne illness. And public health agencies do spend a lot of time and effort trying to get the word out on how to prevent transmission.
Now, we're talking about viruses, but what about bacteria and specifically resistant strains of bacteria that aren't treatable by antibiotics? Is that something that you're looking at as well?
That's not something that we are studying in my lab right now, but that is certainly a major public health threat. And the exact same kinds of modeling approaches and partnerships between academic scientists and public health agencies are going to be very valuable in trying to address. But resistance is also something that we face with viruses as well. One of the issues when we think about stockpiling drugs like Tamiflu or new antivirals against the next pandemic is that these viruses can actually evolve to evade these antivirals so that the drugs are no longer effective against it. And this is one of the things when we're modeling when and where should we actually deploy our antivirals to minimize the burden of illness, we have to weigh this as well. You know, not just who do we need to protect first, but, you know, we have to also weigh the possibility that the virus will evolve resistance to the antiviral drugs if we use too much of it too soon. So the question about resistance is one that actually applies to lots of different kinds of pathogens and is just one of the many different factors that we incorporate in our complex systems models.
One of the things that's interesting about this work, and you've been talking about it to some extent, is that it's so much about collaboration across disciplines. What does this look like? What's hard about that? What are some of the successes of those collaborations?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. Like this work is we're only going to be asking the right kinds of questions as scientists, and our science is only going to benefit public health if we are in regular conversation with the people on the front line. And that can be very rewarding, but it can be also very difficult. The pace of science in universities can be much slower than the pace of decision making in public health agencies. Until recently, I would say that public health agencies, many of the decision makers, they were not as familiar with mathematical modeling, with big data, with those kinds of analytic techniques, and they didn't necessarily appreciate the value of model-based decision-making. And so for many years, it was just trying to open channels of communication between two different worlds. But that has changed quite a bit in the last few years. You know, for example, I mentioned that the CDC itself initiated this Forecasting the Flu contest, which brought together lots of different expert modeling groups across the world. The CDC just launched another new initiative to bring together a bunch of modeling groups that are building models of flu pandemics, and they're going to use these models to help with decision making and planning for the next pandemic. And so very slowly and now very recently, we are seeing the channels of communication support for collaboration really growing between public health and universities. And then even within just the academic, the research side of things, this kind of work really does take interdisciplinary thinking. You know, as we've talked about, understanding how a disease is going to emerge and spread requires understanding sociology. You know, how do people move? How do people behave? It requires understanding virology. How do viruses spread? How do they make people sick? How do antiviral drugs work or not work? And when do they work? It requires evolutionary biology. How do viruses evolve as they spread through populations of hosts? And a lot of the work that we do in particular involves understanding not only kind of sophisticated advanced statistical methods, but also optimization and logistics modeling that comes out of fields like operations research. You know, how do we, once we put all these things into our complex systems model, how do we then make decisions about who to vaccinate, how many drugs to stockpile, where to stockpile them? And that really, to do that kind of analysis well, takes kind of engineering expertise.
It's so interesting that you've got these people all working together toward basically the same goal, which is minimizing the impact of epidemics or stopping epidemics and pandemics, if possible, or treating them to the extent that they're treatable. But because there's so many different areas of expertise going on at the same time, nobody really has an overview. Like, there's no one person who understands the whole thing. Everybody's contributing to it. I mean, that's how complex systems are. But how do decisions get made?
So I am rarely at the table where decisions get made. Usually I'm a few steps away from that, where I'll be working with a public health agency. We will together try to understand what the challenge is, articulate that in a way that a model can help address it. So for example, in the aftermath of the 2009 pandemic, we were working with the state of Texas, and they were reflecting on what went well and what didn't go well. And the state public health agency said, you know, one of the challenges we faced was figuring out how to get vaccines to populations that didn't have sufficient access to healthcare, to doctors, to other providers. And so we articulated that question. We discussed, you know, what were the constraints at the time? Who was getting it? Who wasn't getting it? Who were the vaccines acceptable for? In 2009, there were four different vaccines. Some could be given to kids, some couldn't. Some could be given to pregnant women, some couldn't. And so with them, we tried to understand what were the real world practical challenges they were facing. And then we took that, we built models, we even took those models and we put them into web-based interfaces so that our collaborators in the public health agency could engage with the models, give us feedback. And then we gave them recommendations based on our analysis and based on our models. And then it is up to them then how they are going to use that to actually develop their pandemic preparedness plans, use those insights in real time if and when the next pandemic arises. And so they won't have all the experts sitting around the table. We don't have all the experts sitting around the table at any one time, but we do our best to make sure that the experts are involved at key points in the process of developing models, of analyzing models, and then, you know, giving feedback and giving support to the public health users on the downstream end.
You said at the beginning, the one that keeps you up at night is the flu, influenza. What's it like for you working in this field? I mean, is it stressful just because there's the possibility of this kind of mass illness and death that you're working with?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't literally keep me up every night, but it is something I think about. It is a real threat. When the 2009 pandemic started spreading in 2009, I first got wind of it when everyone else did on CNN, when it came to light that people had recently died from this new flu in Mexico, and then the first few cases came to the United States. And, you know, knowing already then what I did about flu, which is how horrible and severe it was, I found that incredibly alarming, both professionally. I was on the phone the next day with, CDC and other researchers, but also personally. I immediately, I think we probably had online shopping by then, but I somehow got my hands on, N95 face masks for my entire family because I know, well aware of how terrible it could be. And so I think, on a daily basis, I'm not stressed, but I'm very motivated to work with public health agencies to improve forecasting, to improve planning, and to just do what we can to kind of understand and figure out what we can do to prevent something really devastating from occurring.
So you will be giving the ULAM lectures on Monday and Tuesday, September 23rd and 24th. This is an annual lecture series put on by the Santa Fe Institute. It's at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. You're doing two evenings. What are you going to be talking about each night?
Okay, well, the first night, I'm going to be talking more generally about complex systems modeling of outbreaks, and specifically about this network-based modeling that I mentioned earlier in my conversation. The title of my first talk is Outbreak Detection, Prediction, and Containment in Human Social Networks. So there's going to be some kind of basic nuts and bolts of how we do the modeling, and then some examples of how we apply these models to accelerate outbreak detection, the progress we've made so far on being able to forecast outbreaks, and then how we use these models to improve strategies for controlling the spread. The second night, I'm going to focus on influenza. The title is The Elusive Threat of Influenza. I'm going to talk a lot more in a lot more detail about the history of influenza and then focus on the frontiers of influenza forecasting. So we have a lot of different forecasting goals, which we've talked about today. Everything from predicting when is flu going to start spreading, the seasonal flu going to start spreading this fall, to trying to anticipate when and where on the globe is the next deadly pandemic possibly going to emerge. And I'll talk about lots of different efforts to tackle this forecasting challenge that is really just still in their infancy.
And the two evenings are self-contained, so you don't have to go to both, although everybody's certainly welcome to go to both lectures. Once again, September 23rd and 24th, Monday and Tuesday. If you want more information, ladies and gentlemen, santafe.edu. Lauren Ansel Myers is professor of integrative biology and statistics and data science at the University of Texas at Austin. She's external faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.